Welcome to Everything Co-op, bringing you information on how cooperatives can help improve your quality of life. This show is being sponsored by the National Co-op Bank, NCB. The NCB is dedicated to strengthening communities nationwide for the delivery of banking and financial services for the nation's cooperatives, their members, and other socially responsible organizations. For more information on the power of community ownership, visit ncb.coop. That's ncb.coop. Now stay tuned for your host, Vernon Oakes.
Good morning, everybody. This is Vernon Oakes. Welcome to Everything Cooperative. You know, this is February, and this is Black History Month. Started out with 1 week, and now it's up to a month. Started right here in Washington, D.C. And Black History Month is celebrated by the study of African-American life and history. And this year, the theme is the crisis in Black education. The crisis in Black education. Now, one of my favorite friends is on the phone with us this morning, Mr. David Thompson. David, good morning.
Good morning, Vernon. How are you?
Good, good. And one of the reasons you're one of my favorite friends is you know a lot of history.
Well, it's not because of my age.
It's not because you're... I thought you were at least 100. I mean, what... But David, being European descent, we call that white, how did you get so involved in Black history?
Well, I put it all down to... I grew up in England, and I was... my family were living in Boston, England, which is the town, which is the forefather of Boston, United States. There was an American air base near Boston. And this was 1954, 55. And the U.S. Air Force people used to come into town on a Friday to enjoy the weekend. But as soon as they got off the bus, the Black Americans and the white Americans separated completely. And regretfully, in that town, the owners of public houses, the pubs, which my dad was one of them, agreed to have a boycott and not allow for Black American Air Force members to come into the pubs. And my mother and father decided that that was just unacceptable to them, given their own ethics. And given that we had fought a war and America had been on our side, and we didn't pick and choose who was on our side. It was Americans that were on our side. And so they were the only pub that allowed for Black American Air Force people to come in and drink and, you know, play darts and all of those kinds of things. And I was sort of adopted by one American who I have been trying to find and cannot find, whose name was Wes Wesley. But he was a most wonderful young fella. But he was a boxing champion, and I loved boxing. And so he bought me boxing gloves, and we were rationed in England at the time, and so he could get things on base that my parents couldn't get in the grocery store. So he might on the weekend bring us meat or lamb or things like that. Mm-hmm. He brought me double bubble chewing gum, which of course I chewed for the first time and then learned from Wes how to blow a bubble. But anyhow, that was all part of my growing up, and our pub was shunned by the rest of the publicans for having broken the color bar. And my parents stood up and just said, we're open to everybody. So that was, I'd be, 13, 14, 15, when all that was going on. But The Black Airmen came to our pub. They brought us their records. We played them on the pub loudspeaker, and our pub became a favorite haunt for both blacks and whites in Boston that wanted to live across the color bar. And that had tremendous impact upon me as a young person.
David, I thought you were younger than me. If you were 13 or 14 at that age, that means you were older than me.
Well, I'm 74.
Yeah, well, okay, I'll be 70 this year.
Yeah.
And I always thought you were younger, so you, yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you. Okay. It's all that double bubble.
Okay. That is a very interesting story to how you got acclimated or introduced to Black America with the music and the song and the boxing and entertainment and just to know people as people.
Right, right. And one of the things that occurred that I think has a long streak as a result of it is there were a number of black airmen who had their families with them, and one in particular who lived with us, my mum and dad put them up at the pub. We had a boarding house, so people could stay there as well, and so we were the only place in Boston where black airmen could stay overnight, and he lived with us for a while, but it was a little costly because, you know, we had sort of hotel prices, and my mother set out to find a place for him at a much cheaper cost, and she searched all over, and we understood the meaning of racial segregation and housing discrimination and, you know, the issues of, you know, how do blacks find housing when whites don't want to have them in the neighborhood? And I remember walking with that black family all the way, helping carrying their luggage to that place, and just wondering why was it that it had taken so long for somebody to be willing to house this ordinary family, you know, who I really didn't know, you know, about, well, they're black, and so they should be discriminated against, you know.
Well, that's a great segue into the Thurgood Marshall story.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know him as Supreme Court Justice and NAACP lawyer, and I know him as at the top of his game, if you will. But you're telling the story in an article that you wrote that all of his history, and he didn't start that way, right, in Baltimore. So you
right.
Tell us a little bit about his early life.
Well, a number of years ago, I realized that there were a number of co-op connections that Thurgood Marshall was involved in, and I began to sort of track those down. So the pathway kind of leads like this. He went to Howard University to get his degrees, and there he was a member of a cooperative which furnished all of the Howard students and faculty with books and academic support materials and things like that. So that was the first cooperative that Thurgood Marshall was a part of that that I'm aware of.
David, can I stop you a second?
Yeah.
So there was a cooperative bookstore.
Correct.
At Howard. And what I just recently found out through the Dr. Jessica Gordon-Nimhard's book is there was a cooperative bookstore at the little school I went to in Bluefield, West Virginia.
Oh, really? Okay.
And the bookstore made money, and they gave scholarships to students to go on to college, which I found interesting. And then also it was disbanded, and they don't know why, but they said that the Board of Education disbanded it. So I don't know if they said they couldn't keep it up because blacks had more, were getting wealth or had more opportunity. I have no sense of why they would stop something that looked like it was doing a great job, both providing services and getting wealth so that people could continue their education.
Right, right. Well, you know, you may or may not be able to find out, you know, how that happened. The cooperative bookstore, I believe, lasted at Howard for a number of decades, but I don't know why it closed when it finally did.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So he was in a bookstore at Howard while he was going to school and law school. So he went to Howard
right.
and law school.
Right, yeah. right. And there were a number of the teachers at Howard who spoke about the role of cooperatives as a part of economic development and the growth of the black economy. There were a number of professors there who were quite taken by W.E.B. Du Bois in that he espoused cooperatives as a part of the way in which blacks could gain economic freedom and equal rights in the United States. So he probably came across that philosophy. You know, I don't have his record of, you know, which classes he went to and which teachers he took, but undoubtedly he would learn something about cooperatives in that particular era.
So we're talking about 1933, 36.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, the early 30s.
So he's at Howard. He's from Baltimore, comes to Howard. He's going to school, and it doesn't look like he's from a wealthy family.
No. No, he's, you know, from a moderately well-to-do black family, but not a wealthy family. Certainly they were able to support him going to school, which would not be the norm in those days, and especially with him then getting a law degree, which, you know, would take longer. But he was able to do that. He had the support of his family. I think he used to come on the train from Baltimore into D.C. And stayed at home, and therefore he saved money as a result of doing that. But he got his degrees, and he had been noticed as just being a pretty competent lawyer with a tremendous amount of passion for civil rights by a gentleman who at that point headed up the NAACP legal division in New York City. And that person asked Thurgood Marshall to come to New York City to be his second in command. And so
was that was Charles de Houston, who was the vice dean of Howard School of Law?
That's the one. Yep.
And Marshall was number one in his class. Okay.
Yeah. Yes, that fellow is renowned for his legal acumen.
We've got to get ready to take our first break, David.
Sure.
So I think this is a good place to take it. So we've got the first early years of Thurgood Marshall, Baltimore, D.C., with a wealth of history on this cooperative in Howard, except that if you go talk to people at Howard now, there's no knowledge of cooperative, at least as I've tried to talk to people, the dean of the business school, and I'm trying to get into the president. But right now we're going to take our first break. Please don't touch the dial. We'll be right back with David Thompson and more on Thurgood Marshall's life.
Washington, D.C.'s News Talk, 1450 AM WOS and 95.9 FM.
Information is power, and that's why the National Cooperative Bank is sponsoring this program, to give you information about cooperatives so that you could use this information to either start a cooperative, go find a cooperative. As Thurgood Marshall, which we're talking about today, the article that David Thompson wrote reads, Thurgood Marshall, from cooperative apartments to the Supreme Court. So he was in cooperatives early on in his life, both at Howard in the bookstore and, as we'll continue later on, in living in cooperatives in Harlem. So, David, what other cooperatives was Thurgood Marshall involved in early on? We've got the bookstore at Howard, but there was a couple in New York.
Right. He moved to New York with his first wife, whose nickname was Buster, and he had that job with the NAACP, but he didn't really earn enough for them to, you know, keep a budget that was favorable to them. So
you write that it was $2,400 a year. That's $200 a month.
Right. I do write that, and I think to myself, oh my God, you know. So I'm sure in those days, relative to a number of people, that was a better wage than most. But I'm sure for what he did, he was vastly underpaid. But he and his wife had to make ends meet, and they both joined a consumer co-op in Harlem. And one of the things that they did is they delivered goods from that co-op to its members. So they were both a delivery boy and a delivery girl, and they earned extra money doing that kind of thing. And I think that probably brought them lower cost on the goods that they bought from the co-op because they were doing the deliveries for the co-op.
So let me just
he would become, you know, quite familiar with how blacks were running cooperatives in Harlem and other places, and, you know, see that it had a value to its members, and it was a place for them to reduce their food costs, which would then be, you know, after housing, would be their largest secondary cost.
So just quickly, David, a definition of a consumer cooperative. You said he joined a food cooperative. It's a consumer cooperative. A cooperative defined by whoever owns and controls the business. And if it's owned and controlled by the employees, it's called a worker cooperative. If it's owned and controlled by the people that buys and uses the products or services, it's called a consumer cooperative. So you end up with people that come into the store and buy the food and the other things out of the store. They own the business. So they own and control the business. So it's called a consumer cooperative.
Correct.
And he worked there as a delivery boy. Thurgood Marshall. I'm surprised that he had that kind of job.
Well, he probably delivered everything on time and in good shape, and so he was probably a very, very dependable delivery boy because, you know, when you think about what he delivered for black people in America and through his work as a legal person, he was very, very good at delivering what was needed, you know.
So where was he living at that time?
Well, I think first he lived with a relative of either him or of Buster, and they did that for a while, and then a little later on, as he got a little bit more money, he moved into an apartment building, which was a rental building called the Edgecombe in Harlem. Now, at the time, the Edgecombe was regarded as the black White House in the United States. Different other luminaries lived there. The Walter White, who was then the executive director of the NAACP, lived there, and numerous other folks. And so if you had anything important going on in the black community in America, you would frequently end up at the Edgecombe because the inhabitants there were the were the elite. But they were all renters because there was no way for them to find ownership opportunities. And one of the things, I just want to go back a little bit to the consumer co-op.
Okay.
You know, if one could interview people who are dead, you'd learn a lot more history than we do know. But working at the NAACP at the same time as Marshall was Ella Baker. And Ella Baker is one of my great heroines of all women feminist activists in the entire world. She just has a history of having achieved so much, and, you know, some other show we should probably, sort of focus on her. But she was a tremendous organizer of cooperatives during that time. So did Marshall become a member of that cooperative because Ella Baker was on the staff at the same time at the NAACP in the same office? It's quite likely that that occurred. I can't prove it, but quite likely that it did. And one of the gentlemen who was a big voice for the consumer cooperatives in those days was a man called George Shiler, who sort of started life as a liberal black writer, economist, publisher of papers and things like that, and regretfully over time moved to the more conservative side. But Schuyler was enamored with the cooperatives as a way for blacks to get out of poverty. And in fact, he might have been the first black to go to Rochdale in England, because he was given a scholarship to go to England to study cooperatives. And that was at the same, that was in the same era that Thurgood Marshall was a delivery boy at that particular co-op, and when all of that was going on. You know, Black Harlem at that time was, you know, the fountainhead of so much thinking, music, culture, expression, etc. But cooperatives were a big part of the Harlem that was being developed at that time.
You know, it's amazing how all of these names, I like Ella Baker's whole name, Ella Jo Baker.
Ella Jo Baker, yeah.
And there is a co-op here in D.C. that's named after her, Ella Jo Baker Intentional Community. And so I've gotten a little bit about her history through that cooperative. And they've been on the program too, but it's Ella Jo Baker, Du Bois, Marcus Garvey, all of these people, and this, the Snyder person started the Young Negro Cooperative League in 1930.
Correct. That's it. Yeah.
So, what happened to all of his history? Because Jessica Gordon Emhart said the Young Negro Cooperative League, she told me where they used to meet, and I've just lost the name. Oh boy. Okay.
Yeah.
And when I talked to these people about cooperatives that's there now, they knew nothing about cooperatives. Same thing at Howard. I talked to the dean about cooperatives. I was in a meeting and I brought up cooperatives, and there was just total silence. And nowhere had I learned about cooperatives in my growing up. And so 1930, 1940, 1950 in New York, you've got all of these cooperatives going on. And like you said, Thurgood Marshall right here in D.C., right at Howard. And that knowledge isn't there. So that's why we're having this program. And I'm thanking you for what you've done and what your parents taught you early on in your life back in England, that we're all people. Ah.
Well, I feel fortunate, indeed, because it introduced me to a richer part of life as a result. I was going to go back to Ella Jo Baker, though, that... you know, she just spent the early part of her career organizing cooperatives. She used to go to conferences that were held then by the Cooperative League of the United States of America. She got a great deal of education about cooperatives. She was a great cooperative educator in her own right, going around mostly New York, but in other parts of the United States. And, you know, we have other parts to talk about with her, but she was the first staff member for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And she then also became the first staff member for SNCC. And she had always wanted young people to learn about how to organize, because she felt that that was, you know, a critical part of doing it. But her work in cooperatives was the core of her organizing skills. And the way in which cooperatives operate was the way that Ella Jo Baker then taught other organizations how to do things. She was very much a grassroots person, and one who believed in one person, one vote, which is one of the principles of cooperatives, and listening to every voice. And, you know, she and Thurgood Marshall working in that same office in New York City, you know, you can imagine the kind of discussions that went on.
Fantastic.
About what needed to be done to change America.
And some of those need to be talked about right now, but let's go take our second break. David, thank you so very much. We'll be right back. Please don't touch that dial.
Washington, D.C.'s News Talk, 1450.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Vernon Oakes with Everything Cooperative, with David Thompson on the phone with us out of California. David has written an article, Thurgood Marshall from Cooperative Apartment to Supreme Court. So, David, let's go back to this living. He was in an apartment building in New York when he went there to Edgecombe, and then he moved into a cooperative. What was that cooperative?
Is that Morningside Gardens Cooperative. That was a cooperative that had been specifically set up by a group of institutions, including Columbia University, and the Rockefellers put up a fair amount of funding to make Morningside happen, but they wanted to have an example of an integrated building that also provided ownership opportunities to all of the residents who lived there. And Morningside was built. It's, I think it's around about 1,000 units or so. It still exists and does very, very well up there in Morningside near Columbia University. But as the founding members were putting it together, they began to think about who could they approach to live there, whose life could be bettered by their being there. And they thought immediately of Marshall, who was then, of course, the lead at Houston, had left earlier on, and Marshall had become the lead attorney for the NAACP Legal and Educational Fund. They asked he and what was then his new wife, whose name was Sissy. Buster died of a terrible case of cancer during this period. Anyhow, they asked Marshall and Sissy to come and live at Morningside, and so Marshall was one of the first occupants of a unit that had never, ever been occupied before. And, you know, to an extent, this was the first attempt at sort of institutional integration in a cooperative in the United States.
So we get Thurgood Marshall in 1954. They won the Brown versus Board of Education. And
correct.
He was living in the Edgecombe there.
Yes.
And then in 58, when they opened up this Morning Gardens Cooperative, they approached him. So he was well known in 1958 because of the work they had done in NAACP.
Indeed. Indeed he was, yes. But while he was, I think in his first years at Morningside, he became involved in the Little Rock Nine case. And so some of the things that I've been able to find out is that Daisy Bates, who was in essence the shepherd of all of what good and useful came out of the Little Rock Nine case, she talks about going to his apartment, his co-op apartment, and being with the family and being with people like Alex Haley and others, you know, for fundraisers and different things like that. And all of that was happening in this co-op apartment in New York City.
Boy, I would love to have been there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you go to Google and you put in Marshall Thurgood and family, one of the pictures that comes up is a beautiful photo of Thurgood and his wife Sissy and their two boys, because one boy was, when they moved there, one of the boys was a young person, but the other, the younger child was born while they were at Morningside. So that was the first home that Marshall ever owned. It was his first home ownership opportunity in the United States, the first time where he would be able to deduct the mortgage interest and property taxes, just like all other Americans, from his taxes. And he had all of the rights of home ownership, and that came to Thurgood Marshall by being a member of the Morningside Co-op, because he could not find a place to buy because of the discrimination that occurred in New York City and the covenants that prevented you know, mixed race or blacks from owning a home in much of Manhattan.
So all of this reminded you of your experience back in England with the World War II airmen, the black airmen.
Yeah, it surely did.
England, and he could not get a home here in the United States of America.
Right.
In Manhattan.
Correct. Yeah.
Well, I turned to the images, and they got a couple of him right in front of the, I don't know if that's the Capitol building where they're standing in front of. Okay, so Thurgood Marshall now has a bookstore experience in D.C. He cooperative bookstore. He has a cooperative grocer in New York where he delivered food. And now he's in housing in Morningstar. What else did he do as it relates to co-ops?
Well, perhaps, you know, there certainly has to be a high regard for so much of the work that Thurgood Marshall did. But because of my particular interest in housing and in particular in cooperative housing, he played a role that I think highlights the value of housing cooperatives in breaking color bars in the United States. He was hired by a cooperative that was in Illinois called York Center Cooperative. And the York Center Cooperative had been established by a group of people who, after the Second World War, decided that they wanted to have an interracial community. A lot of them were people who had fought in the World War II, and they had fought alongside blacks and whites together. And they went forward, you know, with an idealistic framework of having a cooperative housing venture. And they were being prevented by the FHA, Federal Housing Agency, from being given insurance for the mortgages that they wanted to take out, because the FHA believed at that time that they would make a loan to a black in a black area, but they wouldn't make a loan to a black in a white area. And, you know, they all said it was to protect their capital and their asset. But it was, you know, it was blatant pure racism, without a doubt. And York Center engaged Marshall to do something about that and to enable them to be able to get FHA insurance. At the same time, around the rest of the United States, there were a number of other cooperative communities being put together. One was being developed by Frank Lloyd Wright in New York, just outside of New York City, by a group of mainly Jewish activists from New York City who were trying to start an interracial co-op community. There were two in Los Angeles that were being organized, and there was one in the Palo Alto area. These were all being supported by the cooperative organizations very, very strongly. They were all fairly large cooperatives of between 100 and 500 families that wanted to live together interracially. And eventually, the work of Thurgood Marshall led to his being the main lawyer on the case called Shelley versus Kramer, which was the eventual breakdown of the color bar in housing in the United States. But I have read Marshall's piece that kicked that off with the Supreme Court, and in it he mentions two of these cooperatives as being impaired, you know, by the FHA restriction. The case was won, but the FHA took another 2 to 3 years before they actually did what the court told them that they had done. Mm-hmm. And regretfully, during that period, these were all cooperatives of moderate income people. They were not able to afford the long legal costs of the fight and the long legal costs of holding the land and holding up the process, so that they made certain amends in the way that they did things. You know, for example, the one in L.A. Agreed that racial covenants could be put on the deeds for each of the houses, and therefore they were not, you know, able to allow for blacks to live there. So the hopes of all of these groups were diminished considerably, and in some cases the organizations went out of business because they refused to, you know, have them be whites-only communities. But I think those struggles, those fights, were so critical as a part of breaking down the discrimination in housing, and the cooperatives led the way in the efforts to integrate housing. So I'm very proud of what the cooperatives did during that time, and I'm very grateful that Thurgood Marshall raised his voice, and he wrote a letter to President Truman specifically about this, and talked about these two cooperatives. And then President Truman did an executive order barring the FHA from discrimination.
21-page letter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm good to get a 1 or 2 page letter out of 21 pages.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, this history that is not known. It's also very fascinating. I'm glad that you do your research and bring it out, David, that the research, the history of cooperatives and how the cooperatives have led the way, particularly in housing, but in a lot of different ways, because of the cooperative principles. And the first one is volunteer and open membership. Cooperatives are volunteer organizations open to all persons able to use their services and willing to accept the responsibilities of membership without regard to gender, social, racial, political, or religious discrimination. And all co-ops don't work that way because there's people in co-ops. But when cooperatives that are working that way, it causes them to really get out in front of things like discrimination for housing or any other form for that matter. Love the work you do, David. We've got to take our third break, and we only have one more segment coming up, and we can talk more about Thurgood Marshall. But I also like to change a little bit in this next segment to talk about the environment we are in the U.S. right now with our new president and some of the things that he's doing with banning Muslims or picking up Latin folks and, you know, deporting them, and what that does, if other forms of discrimination. So it's discrimination, whatever it looks like, whether it's blacks or religious or whatever, and how that affects people and what we're doing in the cooperative world to combat those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I know you talked about what happened with the Japanese internment camps, but we'll be right back to talk a little bit more about now and the future. And if there's any other thoughts that you want to talk about the path with Thurgood Marshall, I'd love to hear that too. We'll be right back. Back, everybody. This is Vernon Oakes. Everything Cooperative is our radio show, and we're talking about Black History, Black History Month, with David Thompson, who has written an excellent article on Thurgood Marshall, from cooperative apartments to the Supreme Court, and the work that he has done to overcome discrimination in the courts, changing laws, changing the way our government, FHA, and other government entities treated blacks. So, David, anything else you want to talk about as it relates to Thurgood and this wonderful history?
Well, I'll just add one of the piece that I think stands out, and it also you know, sort of impacts upon the Trump era as well. But during that time, Levittown was created on Long Island. And this was 1949, 1950, 1951. So the same era that Thurgood Marshall is doing all of this wonderful work on behalf of interracial cooperatives, Levittown opens up. And I think in the end it accommodates, you know, 50,000 people, something like that. One of the people who wanted to apply for Levittown was a man called Eugene Burnett. He drove over there very early one morning to be in line because he knew that the lines would be really long. He stood in line for hours along with lots of other people. He was a vet. He had been qualified for the VA, and so he was all excited about the fact that he probably had a pretty good chance of getting one of the houses. And when he got to the front of the line, he was counseled that he should step aside and somebody else would talk with him. And the basic thrust of the conversation was that Mr. Levitt has not yet decided whether blacks can live in Levitt Town. So we'll take your number and your name and address, and we'll put it on a list, and we'll give you a call if that happens. So Barnett drove back to his wife, you know, very sadly, to find out that, you know, the nation that he had fought for, the war that he had fought for, the principles that he had fought for didn't apply to him when he got home, and he was not going to get a home in Levittown. And this town was created with an eventual population of 60,000 people living there, almost all of them being on VA loans or FHA-insured loans, and not one of the residents of Levittown, when it opened up with 60,000 people, were black.
When it opened, not one?
Not one. And so I compare that to Thurgood Marshall's work on, you know, defeating segregation and all of that. So even though he did so much to stop it, the powers of institutions to continue doing that are so much stronger. So you have victories, but then they actually don't take place. And that is, you know, that is one of the dilemmas of law in the United States. We don't have something that makes people do what they're supposed to.
I was just wondering what Eugene Burnett felt like getting up early in the morning.
Well, I believe he wrote a fair amount about it. And so if you go trolling, I guess, on Google, you can learn. But so I know we'll move on to other things. But what I write about in my article is that not everybody who fought in World War II was discriminated against. Because one of the people who did get a house at Levittown was a former U-boat crew member from Germany. How about that for...
Oh, so they let the German in. He fought against us.
Right, right.
Oh, God. They wouldn't let the black in who fought for us.
Right.
But they'll let the German in who fought against us.
So there you are.
Well, my mom and dad met in New York after World War II. They were both in the service, my mother and my father, and they fought in the war. So those were tough times. They didn't talk about it, though. They didn't talk about it.
Well, I'm sure they felt tremendous discrimination, you know, either in rental or ownership.
Well, the other problem with New York, I taught school in New York in 71.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed with my aunt and uncle, not because of discrimination so much, but it was because it cost so much to live in New York.
Mm-hmm.
It just, on a teacher's salary, I taught at City University in New York, but on a teacher's salary, you just could not afford to go out and get your own place. It just wasn't happening. So in your article about the Japanese internment camps, you said that one of the ways that they made it was by forming co-ops.
Correct. Yeah. You know, it's February the 19th is the 75th anniversary of the order by President Roosevelt that all of the Japanese Americans on the West Coast had to be moved inland. And as a result, about 110 to 120,000 Japanese American families were taken off to different temporary camps and then moved to permanent camps. There were 10 camps set up around the United States. They had an average of about 12,000 people each living in them. These were all built in a matter of months in fairly out-of-the-way places. And all of the Japanese-American population on the West Coast was moved to those 10 camps. The organization that I'm on the board of, called Associated Cooperatives, which is based here in Davis, California, we were chosen by the government agency to set up a consumer cooperative in each of the camps. And in particular, I'm more knowledgeable about the one at Manzanar, which is the closest to the Bay Area and therefore had the most relationship to Associated Cooperatives, because our trucks used to deliver on a weekly basis things to the camps, because there were 10,000 people have a lot of needs on a daily basis, you know. Mm-hmm. And we set up cooperatives in those camps. All except one of them had a co-op camp. Another one kind of had a non-profit that worked like a co-op. That was Heart Mountain in Wyoming. But the co-op in Manzanar at its peak in 44 and 45 was the second largest consumer cooperative in the United States. Well, you can imagine what it's like when 10,000 people have only one place to shop at and for most of their daily goods. So it employed around about 250 people. It was the largest employer in the camp. It paid all of the people that worked for it. It paid the largest dividend of any consumer cooperative in the United States in 1944 and 1945. People in the first year didn't know what the patronage dividend is, which is the sharing of the profits of a consumer cooperative or another kind of cooperative with the members according to their patronage. And so for the first year when they paid a patronage, most people had thrown away their slips. They had no idea what patronage dividend meant. They had no idea really what a co-op was. All they knew is that at least they owned, you know, the organization that they were getting stuff from. And the staff, however, almost all had a background in cooperatives because they came from agricultural cooperatives, and they knew that the patronage dividend was a very, very important element of how a co-op worked. So in the first year, the staff made a fortune because they had collected all the receipts of all of these members who had thrown them on the floor and then turned them in. The patronage refund was declared, and they became very rich. But nobody ever left a receipt the second year.
I know that's right. Now, David, we only have about 1.5 million left to go.
Right.
And I could use another hour to talk to you about it. You have so much great information. How does this, the knowledge from that then turns to how we could use cooperatives to help in the situation today?
And we have a minute.
Yeah.
Well, my assumption is we constantly have to teach people about how to work together, how to know that there's an advantage in unity. There are many ways in which that could go on today, uniting our capital through a credit union, uniting our aspects for better communities through housing cooperatives, uniting our interest in better quality food for our children through food cooperatives. There are lots of ways in which cooperatives can, you know, not only strengthen our lives, but give us a platform to show others how to build a better life, because lots of people, you know, just don't know, and there are lots of people who lose hope in times like this, and the cooperatives are, you know, a mechanism for, you know, rebuilding that hope, rebuilding that faith, and learning how to work with each other on those issues which, you know, have a paramount effect upon how our lives are. So I would you know, just suggest that people think about, are there cooperatives that they could be a part of? Is there a credit union that they could join rather than being
out there by themselves? David, thank you. Right. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody. Please have a great week and live cooperative and learn how to work together.
Thank you.
All right.
Washington, D.C.'s News Talk, 1450 AM WOL and 95.9 FM.